Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the second half hour, we're going to be learning more about Governor Greg Abbott's pardon of a murder conviction for a man who gunned down a Black Lives Matter protester. But first, South Texas Congressman Henry Cuellar and his wife are facing federal charges of corruption and money laundering. They are accused of taking foreign money in exchange for Washington, D.C. favors. Cuellar says he is innocent and he is seeking re-election. But the case has reporters digging and finding surprising information about this shadowy world of Azerbaijan money and Washington, D.C. influence. An article out today in the Daily Beast takes a deep dive and comes up with some pearls of information. We're joined by Will Bretterman. He is a researcher on the story inside the secret network behind a Democratic congressman's bribery scandal. And Will, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about this world that you've uncovered, this Azerbaijan, you know, all this money that seems to be flowing around D.C.
Well, you know, in the case of the indictment, the source of the money allegedly was the Azerbaijani state oil company, SOCAR, you know, which has a presence in Texas and, you know, is has made Azerbaijan, which has enormous energy reserves and resources, an extremely wealthy country, and a despite not having a huge population or a huge diaspora, a very influential country, you know, in the West, you know, in the U.S. and Europe, and, you know, has allowed it to sort of throw its weight around a bit. When we began to drill down particularly on the figures in the indictment, a key one is this is referred to in the indictment as Individual 2. And we, as did the Texas Observer, concluded that Individual 2, who was previously a vice consul at the Azerbaijani consulate in Los Angeles, was this gentleman, Elshan Bologlanov. And Mr. Bologlanov runs an import-export firm that matches the description of another company that is alluded to in the indictment that handled allegedly one of the $30,000 bribes directed to the congressman's wife through what are described as sham contracts with the Azerbaijani state oil company. And this company is called WCC International. Well, when we drill down on Mr. Bologlanov's activities and WCC International, we find that WCC International is simply a reincarnation and a new name and a new, you know, sort of trappings on an older company he created while he was still the vice consul called West Coast Connections. He sort of moves from Los Angeles to Maryland, but if you look at the corporate filings in both states, a name pops out as a director of this company, which is a gentleman named Gafar Gurbanov, and I'm almost certainly butchering these names as I'm saying them, but Mr. Gurbanov is known to handle assets internationally on behalf of Azerbaijani's ruling Aliyev family, which has been in power since, I believe, 1993. The other fascinating side of this is that WCC International, one, is a major, substantial recipient, I should say, hundreds of thousands of dollars in U.S. foreign assistance, you know, directed particularly toward agricultural programs via a nonprofit called Cultivating New Frontiers in Agriculture, which essentially disperses money, U.S. Government foreign assistance money. And this lines, you know, basically, you know, just a few months after allegedly giving $30,000, bribe payment to the congressman, this same company is receiving U.S. foreign assistance. The other interesting part of it is it runs a hydroponic farm in Gaithersburg, Maryland, about 30 miles to the north of D.C., which happens to be a supplier to some of the biggest hangouts for political players in Washington, D.C. And I think we're just beginning to you know, skim the surface of this mystery. But there is a rather impressive business network, you know, that is essentially has this individual who is alleged to be an agent of Azerbaijan, you know, behind it. And the network, as the indictment entails and describes, goes much farther than that. But that is just the one sort of angle and piece of it we look at in this story.
So we know the Axum in this type of reporting follow the money. And so is that what we're doing here? Are we seeing breadcrumbs or maybe some designer lettuce that's being left along the ground from these farms that kind of lead you to like, well, this is weird. All of this money from the USDA is going to this one company, and that happens to be connected to Congressman Cuellar?
I mean, it's all weird, no doubt. I mean, at this juncture, you know, this is a story based on public record, and we at this point can say, yes, there is obviously a strong interest by Mr. Bolotnikov, and by the, if you believe the indictment, his superiors in Azerbaijan, you know, and who we know to be connected to a major money manager, as I alluded to, of the Aliyev family, in having proximity to American political figures, and, you know, Representative Cuellar among them, in intervening and inserting himself into U.S.-Azerbaijani affairs. And I should add also, Mr. Bolotnikov's company at one point employed former, and I believe now deceased, Massachusetts Representative Bill Belahunt as a lobbyist for Azerbaijan. I guess what I would say is, yes, we're following the money here, but I think what is interesting to me and interesting in this story is the scale of the network that really straddles two coasts, you know, and ranges from, you know, California to Texas to Maryland and the D.C. area, and the amount of proximity Mr. Bolotnikov and his organization have gotten to, you know, key power centers in each of these states and in the federal government.
So let me ask you real quick. We're almost out of time here. I want to get this real quick question in. Don't have a lot of time. How much influence did Henry Cuellar actually have when he played it as he was one of the few conservative Democrats in D.C.? Did that give him extra muscle?
Well, I mean, we can certainly say that you know, Cuellar, he now has stepped aside from his subcommittee. He was an influential Democrat, you know, had influence in the Appropriations Committee, which is one of the most important committees, you know, in the entire federal government. You do see in the indictment some very interesting elements where he said, well, I tried to do something. He goes back to the Azerbaijanis allegedly and says, well, I tried to do something. It didn't work. You know, but he is alleged to have used his influence in the conference and his you know, position on the committee and on particularly on the Homeland Security subcommittee, you know, to move U.S. policy in the direction of Azerbaijan. Which, again, also has made numerous efforts to improve its image in the United States and in Texas in particular.
All right, we've got to take a break. We've got to say goodbye to our guest, William Bretterman, researcher at the Daily Beast, uncovering some new information about Representative Henry Cuellar. Henry Cuellar continues to remind everyone that he is innocent until proven guilty, and he is running for re-election. Will, it was great to have you on.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be on.
We're taking a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a catastrophe that happened on the border. What's the blame? Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from La Fonda on Main, honoring the authentic cuisine of interior Mexico since 1932. Open for lunch, brunch, and dinner. More information at lafondaonmain.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was on March 27th, 2023, almost a little bit more than a year ago, that a fire whipped through a Juarez immigration detention cell. 40 people were killed in that fire. Activists say the fire and the deaths should not be a surprise to anyone because this is all foreseeable because of U.S. immigration policy. They said this was predictable. They said there were too many migrants detained in Mexico, not enough resources. It was a powder keg. Writing about that, we're joined by Perla Trevizio. She is a reporter for the ProPublica Texas Tribune Investigative Unit. Perla, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So you wrote about this fire a year ago. I'm really glad that you did take a pause to see what happened with this tragedy. You know, you're telling us that U.S. foreign policy, immigration policy, through the Trump years and through the Biden years, that led to this. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so I think, you know, starting in 2019 under Trump, for the first time, Mexico accepted to receive non-Mexican foreign nationals. So, you know, obviously the U.S. has always been able to deport Mexican nationals back to Mexico, but for the first time, people who were not from Mexico were allowed to be sent back to Mexico under a program called the so-called Remain in Mexico program. Then when the pandemic came, Trump used Title 42 to expel most people who approached the border. And again, some of them were returned to their home countries, but Mexico, again, was accepting non-Mexican nationals. And what this started to create was this pressure situation in cities like Juarez that were not used to being a place where migrants stayed for a long time. You know, places along the northern border have long been cities through which migrants passed through en route to the United States. But for the first time, people were being stuck in the cities that lacked the resources to care for them. Then when President Biden came in, you know, he when campaigning, he promised to undo many of the policies of his predecessor. And he did start by suspending the MPP or the Remain in Mexico program, but kept Title 42 for a bit longer, partly because of the situation at the border, partly because of legal challenges, and then ended up expanding Title 42 to include other nationalities, starting with Venezuelans, when those numbers started rising to levels not seen before. And you can kind of start seeing that pressure continue to build up in Juarez as this policy shifts continue, where you have more people on the streets leaving in tents, protesting their conditions. People who had been allowed to present themselves at a port of entry in the U.S. all of a sudden were stuck in a city that they did not meant to stay, where they could see the U.S. flag waving just across the river.
Well, they were in a city that didn't want them, that they were victimized in by, you know, the cartels, and the general public didn't want them there either. But talk about the conditions that were in this facility that they were in. You focused on Stefan Arango. He was a Venezuelan citizen. He was in Juarez, and he was in this facility. What was it like?
Yeah, so Juarez only had one immigration detention center, and it was built in the 90s. It was part of a larger government building that was meant to hold foreign nationals for short periods of time, you know, a couple of days. It was basically a cell. There were two cells, one for men, one for women. The men's cell was just this cavernous kind of big room with no beds, it had a couple of two bathrooms for detainees. It was only supposed to hold up to 80, and that was already at its maximum capacity. And it did not have the conditions. But as we start seeing more people come in and the pressure increasing of stopping migrants from reaching the U.S. border, you start seeing more and more of them being brought in to this center and being kept for longer periods of time. So the migrants, including Stefan, who you mentioned, and others who testified in court and others we've interviewed, have described this environment that was, you know, of filth, smells that were nauseating, where feces was smeared on the walls, where the toilets did not work properly, where, you know, people hadn't showered in days. They had to eat in that same area. They didn't have beds. They had to sleep on kind of those gym sleeping mats kind of that you see that are covered in vinyl. For blankets, they had those thermal Mylar blankets. There was no ventilation. So there were not conditions appropriate at all to hold people.
It was like a hellhole. That's what it sounded. Just terrible.
It definitely does not sound pleasant, yes.
So they had all these people over capacity, at least 100, according to your reporting, in this space, overcrowded, and you have the men, they decide to rebel.
So men had been protesting. From what we gather, again, from the surveillance footage and interviews, it seems that throughout the day there were sweeps around the city. So as you mentioned, I think, you know, the feelings in Ciudad Juarez from the local residents were mixed emotions, right? I think you had the people who still felt like we need to help our fellow migrants. There were people who, as the numbers grew and frustrations increased, that felt that enough is enough and we can't do this anymore. And you even had the city's mayor saying our patience is running out. And so that the day of the fire, they had been sweeps around the city, picking up people who were selling candy or peddling on the streets. And you also had the federal immigration agents picking up people from around the border wall area. And so throughout the day, you had been bringing more and more people. Some had been there for days. There are at least a couple that we know had been there since February. So for at least weeks. And tensions were, you know, people were growing desperate. They were saying that there was not enough water. They were not, they did not have enough food. It was hot. They were afraid of being deported at this point, you know, especially if you're from Venezuela, you've traveled thousands of miles, you cross the dangerous Darien Gap, the jungle portion between Panama and cross through whole Mexico, where as you point out, they're often victims to cartel and organized crime violence, and including local government officials. And so people were growing very desperate and calling to be released. And when they say that the guards ignore them, they threaten with lightning the sleeping mats. I mean, and it's important to point out that when they enter this cell, they're supposed to have had everything removed, their shoelaces, any of their belongings, but somehow they managed to get it appears that they managed to get a lighter inside and did in fact light those mattresses on fire. And video that we obtain, you can see how the flame starts spreading and the cell starts filling with smoke. And the migrants are banging on the bars, and you see kind of the guards scrambling up and down, trying to figure out how to let, you know, if there's a side door, they're trying to find the keys to open it. And eventually they leave. Stefan, the Venezuelan who we talked to, says that, you know, he pleaded, brother, please don't let us in here. We're going to die. And he was just told, good luck, dude. And the guard allegedly turned his back and fled. And so within minutes, you know, the smoke took over the cell and the migrants start losing consciousness.
And 40,
as you pointed out,
died.
40 of them died. 40 of them died. 27 of them were injured. There were also additionally 15 women in the adjacent cell who were evacuated. But, you know, some of them had their fathers in that cell. They had their partners in that cell. So you can only imagine hearing the screams of desperation as you're standing outside and not being able to do anything about it.
So what you lay out in the story with this progression of U.S. foreign policy, immigration policy with Mexico, you write that not only did Trump try to build the wall, he wanted to turn Mexico into a wall. And as you have a buildup of migrants on the other side of the Rio Grande in Mexico, in a place that does not want them and does not have the ability to care for these people, these types of tragedies, they're to be expected, right?
Yeah, so I think, you know, even, and as I mentioned in the story, we went back starting with the Obama administration. So the increasing responsibilities on Mexico to stop migrants from reaching the U.S. border, you know, precedes Trump and precedes Biden and to a certain extent even Obama. But with Obama, we start seeing more of a concerted effort to stop people, but it was usually in the southern part of the country. But, you know, throughout these years, we've seen State Department reports on human rights conditions in Mexico consistently cite the concerns and human rights violations in Mexico when it comes to migrants, at times perpetrated by the country's own immigration and law enforcement officials. We found Congressional Research Service reports consistently voiced this those warnings. I found language in appropriations bill saying, you know, we are concerned that the human rights violations are being violated and they're not being held accountable. The immigration agents are not being held accountable. We had letters from lawmakers, and you see this kind of build up as we have more of that bottleneck in the north, and including there had been at least that we could independently verify at least 13 similar fires where migrants protesting conditions of overcrowding and filthy conditions and inside detention centers had done something very similar, where they had set mattresses on fire or the Milo blankets on fire as a way to kind of force the immigration agents to release them. There had even been an incident in 2019 in that same detention facility in Juarez, where a group of Cubans set their mats on fire, and that time about 60 of them were able to escape unharmed. Even previous, prior to the fire, you had a letter from Democrats in January, and you had a report from the Congressional Research Service on March 13, saying, the system is reaching its tipping point.
So, are these types of conditions they're still happening today, I imagine?
So following the fire, the Mexican government permanently shut down the Juarez facility and temporarily shut down 33 other temporary detention centers as they underwent a review. I had reached out to the Migration Institute to see what was the plan, because the National Commission on Human Rights from Mexico evaluated all these detention centers and found most of them to be inadequate and found deficiencies in all of them. And so I reached out to the Institute to see what was their plan to reopening and operating these facilities, given the commission's report, but I did not receive an answer. There have been reports that there are plans to open a new detention center in Juarez or in the outskirts of Juarez, but that has not come to fruition as of now.
What was the United States reaction to this fire, seeing how this was the creation of these conditions was the result of U.S. immigration policy?
So when we reached out to the administration, to the White House, they would not comment on specific questions or on the U.S.'s responsibility when it came to the fire. They did tell us that, that the facility was not under the jurisdiction of the U.S. government, and they highlighted the fact that, President Biden has focused on expanding legal pathways for people to apply to come to the U.S. legally from their home countries to avoid the dangerous trek. Following the fire, there had been a couple of press conferences where reporters had asked the administration about this, and they did not think that they shared any of the responsibility regarding what had happened in Juarez. And I think part of it was also mentioning that it was, the fire happened in Mexico. It did not happen in the U.S. Therefore, those are questions for Mexico, not the U.S. government.
Perla Treviso is a reporter for the ProPublica Texas Tribune Investigative Unit. She is reporting on a year ago, 40 men were killed in one of the deadliest incidents involving immigrants in Mexico's history in Ciudad Juarez as a result of U.S. foreign policy, immigration policy. Perla, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about Governor Greg Abbott's pardon of a convicted murderer. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
The EarthX 2024 Environmental and Sustainability Congress of Conferences is happening in Dallas, April 22nd through the 26th, bringing together all sides with one important mission: protect our planet. For info, earthx.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Daniel Perry is now a free man, even though he was convicted of murdering Grant Foster. Foster was a Black Lives Matter protester, but he was gunned down by Perry in Austin. Governor Greg Abbott has now pardoned Perry, claiming that it was self-defense. In light of this pardon, what does stand your ground mean to you? Does stand your ground, does it apply to everyone? Do certain people get to claim stand your ground? How does that work? Stephen Monticelli is a freelance investigative journalist, and he's been writing about this controversial pardon for the Texas Observer. And Stephen, welcome back to The Source.
Thanks for having me, David.
What first sticks out to you about the peculiarities, and there's a lot of them, about Governor Greg Abbott's pardoning of Daniel Perry?
Well, there's a number of peculiarities, as you've mentioned. But the first that really stuck out to me in the announcement of this pardon was the timing. This pardon came out the same day that the Board of Parole and Pardons issued its recommendation. Now, that is unusual for Governor Abbott, who you typically announces pardons 2 days before Christmas every year. And he's also the type to have issued few pardons, and typically for only lesser offenses. So for the fact for Greg Abbott to have pardoned a murderer, someone who was unanimously convicted by a jury, also stands out, I think, as highly unusual for him.
Daniel Perry, his personal history, this was part of a, the right-wing media really said that this guy was a U.S. Army sergeant. He deserved to be given some leniency. How did that become part of the storyline?
So, as you mentioned, Daniel Perry, U.S. Army sergeant, is a veteran and has been sort of made a cause célèbre of the right wing. Something that they've spoken less about is that the man he murdered, Garrett Foster, is also a veteran, a U.S. Air Force veteran. That is a bit of an inconvenient fact for the right, given that Garrett was an Air Force veteran who was openly carrying a gun legally in the state of Texas at a protest, which is something that we've seen at protests around Confederate monuments, for example, by groups that want to support them. Daniel Perry's background is a little more complicated than him just being this veteran. As court documents revealed, he had been openly fantasizing about committing violence to BLM protesters for quite some time in text messages with his friends. He had sent racist messages. He had just talked about wanting to hunt Muslims. But really, the most shocking fact that stands, I think, in direct contradiction to a major right-wing talking point that's been heard for the past several years is that Daniel Perry was messaging with a self-identified minor who he had basically told he wanted to be his boyfriend, or he wanted to be their boyfriend, rather, and sent these really suggestive, borderline explicit, if not outright explicit messages to minors. And this is coming at a time when still today we hear from Republican elected officials a lot of panic around alleged sexualization of children in public schools. None of that has really come up. None of what I've mentioned, the racist messages, the desire to commit violence against a protester, the messages with a teenager, or really the fact that Daniel went out of his way to go to Austin to find one of these protests and sort of insert himself in a situation, none of that has come up in any of the conversation that we've heard from Abbott or any of the supporters of the pardon.
Right. So we need to kind of set the scene here of what happened with this shooting. And I do want to say our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Call in. You've got a question or a comment about this pardon from Governor Abbott, and what does stand your ground mean to you? So we have this, Black Lives Matter protest going on in Austin. We have Daniel Perry. He's an Uber driver, and he drives at the scene, into the scene. What do you know about what happens?
So as far as we can tell from court records and from eyewitness reports, Mr. Perry actually ran a red light ahead of the fateful incident where he shot and killed Garrett Foster. He seemingly was driving towards the protest intentionally so. and put himself in a position where he was surrounded by protesters who, at the time, I think rightfully so, may have been concerned for their own safety, given that we've seen incidences of right-wing provocateurs and assailants, really, driving cars into crowds of protesters. So I think the most dramatic example of that was back at the Unite the Right protest many years ago in Charlottesville, where a basically far-right activist drove his car into a crowd of people and killed a woman. So, you know, in that context, I think protesters may have rightfully considered a car moving towards them as potential threat to their lives, given that you know, cars are one of the leading causes of death in our country. So, you know, with that all in mind, it was a very sort of heated powder keg of a moment in which Perry had driven his car towards this crowd and was effectively, you know, met by the crowd, which included Garrett Foster, who at the time was open carrying an AK-47 style rifle.
So according to the reporting, the crowd was kicking the car and rocking the car, you know, moving it back and forth. Yeah,
that is also, I think, what we have heard, in that they, you know, were angry that this driver had put themselves into this situation. And photos and eyewitness reports confirm that, you know, Garrett and others approached the car. And I haven't seen any reporting that Garrett himself was involved in the pushing or shaking of this car. But he did have his rifle angled towards the ground.
In the safety position.
Correct. There was no bullet in the chamber. He did not aim the rifle at Daniel Perry, according to eyewitnesses, as well as testimony from Mr. Perry himself, who in an interview with law enforcement in a video which has been publicly released, acknowledges that he didn't want to give Garrett Foster a chance to aim at him.
Right, so he was afraid for his life because he thought that Garrett Foster was going to aim at him, but he hadn't aimed at him at all.
Correct.
Okay.
So in that sense, you know, it's an interesting question, because if members of the crowd had potentially feared for their lives, and so did Daniel Perry, it's unclear sort of who has the right to stand their ground or act in self-defense. Is it the person who decides to shoot first? Is it the person who, you know, is not open carrying a rifle, but is carrying a pistol? Those aren't things that I think are clear in this context.
Yeah, it's like the Wild West, you know. You have a shootout and you just say self-defense and okay, it's all good. You know, I mean, is that where we're at now?
Well, I think a lot of people are taking that message away from this decision to pardon Daniel Perry and restore his gun rights. In that, you know, the unanimous decision of a jury has been discarded. There are claims that exculpatory evidence was withheld, but the Board of Paroles and Pardons, neither them nor Greg Abbott, have released this evidence that they claim is exculpatory.
Right. We'll get into that in a second. I'm going to go to a caller. Let's go to Deborah on the line. And Deborah, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. My opinion is Abbott knew exactly what he was doing by pardoning him. He can't stop the students from UT protesting. And by pardoning Garrett, that's basically saying it's open season on protesters here in Texas, that he is going to allow citizens to harm these protesters. If Garrett can get away with it, then anybody else can get away with shooting a protester, running over a protester.
Deborah, thank you for your call. Stephen, can I get your reaction to that?
So I think that is something that a lot of people are reasonably taking away from this, in that you know, there's this history, right, of sort of vigilante violence being tacitly endorsed by governments across the world. In this moment, we are seeing a widespread protest movement that Abbott has issued directives with the attempt to sort of quash by defining some of their popular slogans as hate speech. And now a convicted murderer was pardoned outside of the typical pardon schedule very rapidly. You know, the idea of pardoning him came up before he was even sentenced and placed in jail. And so I don't think it's unreasonable for people to be concerned and to take that message away, in that everything about the case, everything about Garrett Foster, he would have normally been held up as, you know, someone who had his rights violated. He wasn't committing any crime by participating in this protest. He just happened to be at the wrong protest from the perspective of Governor Abbott and those who oppose that movement.
Right. So I got to take this break here, but our phone lines are open, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. This Stand Your Ground law of self-defense. Governor Abbott says that's why he gave the pardon to Daniel Perry. But is it to really depend on who did the shooting and who gets to have this benefit of a politicized pardon? Was it politicized, you know, weaponized? Call in, tell me what you think. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about Governor Abbott's pardoning of Daniel Perry for the convicted murder of a Black Lives protester. And so, Stephen, I want to read to you. This is the proclamation that Abbott signed. So he says, whereas Daniel Scott Perry's car was immediately surrounded by aggressive protesters who rushed to obstruct, strike, pound, smash, and kick his vehicle. And whereas Grant Foster then approached within 18 inches of Daniel Scott Perry's car, confronting him and brandished a Karivna Scott, AK-47 style rifle in a low ready firing position. And whereas Daniel Scott Perry fired his handgun at Garrett Foster to eliminate a perceived threat to his safety and called law enforcement less than 1 minute later to inform them of the incident. And whereas Daniel Scott Perry explained to law enforcement at the time that he used his weapon because he feared losing his life, and he since consistently stated that he acted in self-defense. These whereases seem to be very selective.
Yes, I would agree. It is very selective, and they couldn't help but take the opportunity to take a pot shot at a longtime target of political ire, the Travis County DA.
Yeah, so that's the next whereas. Travis County District Attorney Jose Garza, rather than upholding the self-defense rights of citizens, has prioritized reducing access to guns that citizens may use to lawfully defend themselves. I don't know why that's in there other than to make a political jab. Whereas District Attorney Garza directed the lead detective investigating Daniel Scott Perry to withhold exculpatory evidence from the grand jury considering whether to report an indictment. And whereas the DA Garza had not sought to see that justice is done. So is this a way to go after the DA as well? Could he be unseated?
Right. So this is, I think, a part of a larger pattern in which DAs like Garza, who have been popularly elected, have, been the focus of ire from politicians like Abbott. There was a bill passed, I think, in the last legislature that effectively created a mechanism to remove DAs that were seen as not upholding the law.
And we've seen that in Nueces County. That district attorney was unseated.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Garza has been one of the individuals, I think, who's been on the sort of target list of DAs that are considered to be not upholding the law, as clearly stated by Abbott in this proclamation. However, what they've accused Garza of directing someone to withhold evidence, I believe that is a crime, whether it would be Garza, the person who withheld the evidence. And yet we still haven't seen any sort of action or movement in terms of charging Garza for this alleged crime or any release of the allegedly exculpatory evidence that the Parole and Pardons Board claims they've made their decision.
Right, that would be prosecutorial misconduct. But do we have any idea what Abbott is talking about here? What is this evidence?
I have no idea. We haven't seen any of that released yet. There could be a number of reasons why it has not been released. But I would operate under the assumption that if it were so clearly, exculpatory for Daniel Perry, that they would be eager to release it in the same way that many documents from the trial have already been publicly released.
Let's go to caller Bonnie. And Bonnie, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to point out that once the pardon is signed, there's nothing we can do about it. That's what I understand. The other thing is that I did not hear anything about this incident until this guy was pardoned. And I wonder why that is. I mean, I listen to this station all the time. Thank you.
All right. Well, Bonnie, thank you for that. So to the first point, is there anything that can be done after the pardon is given?
As far as I'm aware, no, there is not anything that can be done in terms of bringing up the same sort of charges that would, I believe, be double jeopardy, which is not allowed. And unless there were some other crime that Daniel Perry had not been charged with or that the DA had not pursued in terms of, you know, bringing those charges forward and trying to prosecute them. I do not believe there's anything that can be done. If it was a state crime and it was not under federal jurisdiction, I don't see how anything would change after the issuance of this pardon.
So the other point that Bonnie had is she hadn't heard about this case until, you know, this pardon part of it. But if you watch Fox News, they talked about it quite a bit, defending, the shooter, Daniel Perry. It was covered in the news some, but basically up until the pardon, it seemed like, the wheels of justice were going to run their course.
That's correct. There was a decent amount of coverage when it first happened. There was also, I think, a decent amount of coverage when Abbott announced his intention or desire to sign a pardon shortly after Perry was convicted, within a day. And now we're hearing a lot more about it. But I think there's a couple of reasons why, perhaps it did not reach the same sort of level of national discourse as, say, the Kyle Rittenhouse case. Because I think, to your point, it did seem like the case, was pretty clear cut. There wasn't a lot of disagreement. It was a unanimous decision. So, there's a number of reasons why people may have missed it. But I think this pardon has certainly elevated the instance to higher level of discourse and brought up a number of new concerns about what message it sends.
So Perry, Abbott used the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles. They conducted an exhaustive review of this, according to Abbott's statements. But that is a body that is appointed by Abbott, right?
Largely, yes. So the body is appointed by Abbott, and I think there's also some role that the state Senate plays, which is effectively controlled by Dan Patrick. And they've been in office for quite some time. And I think, if I am not mistaken, they have had a hand in appointing every current sitting member of that board. In effect, they have placed people onto this board and are responsible for that and, very likely have some sort of influence on.
Well, when Governor Abbott makes a public announcement that he wants a pardon, these people, they hear that, they see that headline, and they know what to do. You know, they're not going to count. They're not going to go against the governor.
I think that's a fair assumption to make. The statement released by the board was very brief. I think it was about 3 paragraphs. And it did not provide much detail about exactly what went into this decision. And frankly, it's also befuddling to understand what the exceptional circumstances were that allowed for the Board of Plurals and Pardons to even hear this case. Because typically, people only are able to bring forth, you know, a petition to be pardoned if they're already in jail. And there are, according to the board's rules, exceptional circumstances that, you know, arise and, you know, justify the decision to hear a pardon. So it is.
So they don't review every murder that happens in Texas, only the ones that Governor Abbott, you know, puts on the front page.
I mean, I don't think we've seen a pardon like this in recent memory.
What does this mean? Do you think people are going to see this? Does this make Texas less safe?
Well, I think it makes Texas less safe for protesters of a particular flavor. I think it's hard. It would be hard to imagine this sort of, scenario playing out if it had been a left-wing protester who was open carrying, shooting a, you know, right-wing activist in self-defense. I do not think Abbott would be treating the scenario in the same way. And I think it sends a clear message in terms of what someone could expect if they end up, you know, shooting a left-wing protester in an environment and in a situation like this where they can reasonably, maybe not even reasonably, but can attempt to claim self-defense. And if it were to be the other situation, I don't think that, you know, we would hear the same sort of calls for review and pardon.
Do you think the Second Amendment crowd, the ones who want open carry, that they should be asking some questions about this? I mean, because, the victim was following the law.
Right. Yeah, we do have a bit of a contradiction on our hands where Abbott signed a law that says you can do what Garrett Foster was doing. But on the other hand, he has also pardoned someone who shot Garrett Foster for doing something legally. Now, the argument that I have heard people make is that by participating in a protest that was in a public right of way, and by impeding Daniel Perry, they were no longer legally carrying. They were participating in a criminal act, and therefore the situation is somehow different. I don't think that's a very convincing argument, frankly. There are First Amendment arguments for that sort of protest, and there are Second Amendment arguments for Foster's decision to carry that rifle. But I think the most cynical interpretation that, unfortunately, is somewhat grounded here is that those laws only really matter if you are a part of a group of people who the law protects but does not bind. And unfortunately for the rest of the people who are not in that group, the law will bind and not protect.
Stephen Monticelli is a writer. He wrote about this for the Texas Observer. You can find it at texasobserver.org. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.